Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Obama said today auto jobs will be lost and plants will not reopen. Obama spoke to reporters today after rejecting the restructuring plans from General Motors and Chrysler and forcing GM CEO to resign over the weekend.
Today I'm announcing that my administration will offer GM and Chrysler a limited additional period of time to work with creditors, unions, and other stakeholders to fundamentally restructure in a way that would justify an investment of additional taxpayer dollars.
GM and Chrysler have asked for an additional $21 billion from the government. What happens if they don't meet Obama's timeline? Justin Hyde is Washington correspondent for the Detroit Free Press. And so, Justin, the president has said shape up or else. Let's see what the or else is. Start with General Motors. What do they have to do and how much time do they have to do it?
Well, Robin, the president gave GM 60 days to come up with a new viability plan that goes further than the one that the company submitted back in February. That does mean more job cuts likely, more plant cuts. The president even raised the possibility that more brands would have to be shed by GM. It was already cutting four. The government has not talked as much about what happens if GM doesn't come up with that plan. They've emphasized that they see a viable future for GM if it can make the kind of cuts that it believes are necessary to survive in the long term.
Well, as economists note, the word bankruptcy scares people, but the president seemed to be aware of that today, going out of his way to say whatever happened, it would be something different, a quick rinse bankruptcy?
I think there's a lot of bankruptcy that I think is one of the keys to this whole program. One of the major hurdles that these companies have is the amount of debt that's on their balance sheets. Part of the agreements of the original loans was that they had to reach concessions from their bondholders. That process has been stalled for months. An analyst will tell you that without a credible threat of bankruptcy, there is nothing that would keep a bondholder from agreeing to such concessions if the government's pressuring them to do so. If you, throughout this process, the administration is saying that bankruptcy is an option even if the plan is successful. They can see they can forecast a situation where GM and Chrysler come up with a plan to survive and need a bankruptcy court to put it into effect. Obama said that that process would be a very temporary type of bankruptcy, something that administration officials imagine would last less than 30 days. They would go into court, have the deal ratified, and then come back out as viable companies ready to pay back the government loans.
Right. And
For Chrysler, they did say, though, that should Chrysler not be able to complete a deal with Fiat within 30 days, bankruptcy is going to have to be the only option for that company, and that process would not get any sort of government banking.
Yeah, Chrysler has been given a 30-day window to work out some kind of partnership with Fiat. Well, what else jumped out at you today, Justin?
The president spent a lot of time talking about the impact of his plan on Detroit and the Midwest. He has appointed an official to be director of auto recovery, a gentleman by the name of Earl Montgomery, a former deputy secretary of the Labor Department, who will be tasked with funneling some of the Recovery Act money for job training and job assistance into these communities that are hard hit by this program. He compared, in fact, the decline of the auto industry to a natural disaster, saying just as the government offers aid to areas that are hit by a tornado or a hurricane, it should offer aid to areas that are hit by an economic tsunami, just as the Midwest has been.
But he was also very explicit, and this struck us, that the U.S. government would stand behind car warranties issued by both Chrysler and GM.
Yes, that's very unusual. It's not something I think that's ever happened, really, in the history of the auto industry. And part of that goes back to bankruptcy. When the companies were originally presented with pressed on the idea of going bankrupt, one of their objections was that buyers would not shop from a bankrupt automaker, in part because they would be worried that their warranties would not be honored. By saying that the government will stand behind the warranties of GM and Chrysler, and in fact opening that program to other automakers if they so choose, the government is trying to remove the objection to bankruptcy and make it a more realistic possibility that companies could jump into court, get the restructuring that they might need, and then jump back out and still have enough customers to survive.
Well, that's Justin Hyde, Washington correspondent for the Detroit Free Press, speaking to us from the press room at the White House. Justin, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, today, Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm called the forced resignation of GM chief Rick Wagoner a sacrificial lamb. The company did lose $70 billion in the last 2 years of his heading that company. So is his firing the beginning of a new trend? Let's put that question to our next guest. Simon Johnson was chief economist with the International Monetary Fund in 2007 and 2008. As he writes, he was the guy no country wanted to see because it meant they were in economic failure, and he was going to tell them things they didn't want to hear including fire the powerful elites who caused the problems in the first place. Johnson currently teaches at MIT. He joins us now from the studios of the Peterson Institute for International Economics, where he's a senior fellow. Simon Johnson, welcome back.
Nice to be with you.
And we want to talk to you about many things, including Wednesday's big G20 economic summit. But you've written a much-talked-about article in The Atlantic magazine about what you call the recent reemergence of an American financial oligarchy. So with that in mind, your thoughts on Wagoner's surprise firing?
Well, I think it's very interesting, and it's obviously a significant departure. The administration is exerting its power and influence over the auto industry. But to me, the contrast is quite striking with regard to the finance industry. For example, a couple of weeks ago, Treasury said that the CEO of Citigroup, Mr. Vikram Pandit, will stay on in his job, despite the fact that you could, the same sort of issues that you can ascribe to Mr. Wagoner, and many people raise those same or similar issues about Mr. Pandit at Citigroup. So we defer to one set of elites and we're tough on another set of elites. It's quite interesting.
Well, and take it even further, more than interesting, you say that when other countries would come to you hat in hand to ask you for money at the IMF, they were all in dire straits for one reason. Powerful elites within them, within the countries, had overreached in good times and taken too many risks. And that governments and business allies form sort of an oligarchy running the countries like profit-seeking companies. But we don't think of people like Rick Wagoner or even the head of Citibank as oligarchies. In an American mind, that's like a family in Russia that's had control of an industry for a long time. So what do you mean?
Well, I mean control over an industry. That's definitely true. Every oligarchy is different, but every emerging market, every middle-income country that's open to capital flows, it gets itself into serious difficulties. There's always a powerful set of people who do well initially, and perhaps you could argue do well for everyone, but then they get carried away. They overborrow, they overexpand, and there's a crisis in which some of them have to lose, and some of them have to lose pretty big, and that's the essence of the political struggle and moving on towards recovery.
Well, are you saying that the U.S. is now following in the footsteps of Argentina, Russia, other countries that have had to come to you with hat in hand?
Yes, I am saying exactly that. And many people, you know, are pushing back on this. They're saying we're not like Argentina or Russia. And I'm not saying that we're exactly like them. I am saying we have a more sophisticated elite. Our oligarchy, if you like that term, gets the job done in different ways. They have what I would say more of a cultural capital approach rather than using violence or using corruption. So they control a lot of the ideas. It's those people who are now in power again in Washington, running Treasury, in senior jobs in the White House and so on. So there's an intertwining of Wall Street and Treasury. Jagdish Bhagwati at Columbia, professor at Columbia, calls it the Wall Street Treasury complex, referring, of course, back to the 1950s when Eisenhower talked about a military-industrial complex in the U.S. And I think that's a nice way to think about the sort of shifting elite and shifting power structure. We've gone from being a country where it was big manufacturing that had a lot of the power, including GM, to a country where it's big finance that has a lot of power and I think too much power.
And you point out that in addition to this cozy business and government relationship, there are other issues. There's, of course, the lightweight regulation, bad mortgages, but all the problems also benefited the financial sector. What happens now? Because you say the analogy between the U.S. and other countries ends from here on out, because countries that would come to the IMF usually came when they ran out of money. The U.S. is still rich.
That's right. So we could actually keep this going, this mess, to use a technical term, we could keep it going for quite some time because we're not going to have the same sort of crisis that a Korea or a Russia or an Argentina has had. And that's good that we don't have the crisis, but you know, it won't be as dramatic and as difficult perhaps. But it's also bad because it means we won't have a moment of resolution. There isn't really going to be as much pressure on us to clean up our financial system and to manage its downsizing and its unwinding in the same way as these other countries have had to do.
Well, why is that? Because you say that the Obama administration should be kicking down doors, nationalizing banks, kicking out the CEOs, and as you said at the start, how come the bank CEOs are getting to stay? You know, and it just always raises the question. We hear this from you. We hear it from people like Paul Krugman. We hear it from the former finance minister of Sweden. These are ostensibly very bright people in Washington. Why is the U.S. not doing what so many voices say should be done?
Well, the financial sector in the U.S. is very powerful, and one sort of part of their power, ironically enough, comes from their weakness. So they're saying to people in Washington, look, if you take any of these dramatic actions, or even if you contemplate a more dramatic, say, recapitalization of the banking system using government money, so the government would end up with majority ownership, even if you hint at that, that will cause a massive collapse, further collapse in the financial system in the U.S. and around the world. And remember that their intellectual capital and their cultural capital is so strong, it's very easy for them to persuade people. There's very few people who will stand up to them publicly and debate these issues on their merits.
Well, I sat next to Congressman Barney Frank at a fundraiser, and you well know how sharp his responses can be. And I said to him, how are you responding to all these voices calling for nationalizations of banks? Why isn't that being considered? And he said, to what end? What would it do? So, I mean, there seems to be a real disconnect.
Yeah, I think it's a good question, to what end? And the answer is reprivatization. You don't take over these banks in order for the government to run them. I mean, I don't know about you, but every time I go to the DMV to get my driver's license renewed, it's a bad experience. So if the government can't even handle driver's licenses in a pleasant way, I don't want them running banks. But the fact of the matter is that the government has taken over, provided massive amount of financial support. It's appointing or reappointing CEOs in the financial sector. We're pouring billions of dollars into defunct financial structures such as AIG. We've kind of nationalized this nonsense already. What you need to do is a more systematic approach, clean the thing up, recapitalize it, and then privatize it, get it back into the hands of the private sector, and make these banks smaller, make them compete more with each other, break down this monopoly, oligopoly power that's led to the too big to fail and almost too big to rescue syndrome, and we got to move on. So I think it's a very fair question that Congressman Frank is asking, but there is a pretty reasonable, straightforward answer.
Is one of the problems in the U.S. in particular, going back to the things the government should do on that list, is wipe out shareholders. Here in the U.S., more Americans than ever before in history, are stockholders. They may not even know that they have stocks in a bank or an investment house. Here, when you wipe out the shareholders, you're wiping out more than the elite.
The shareholders have been essentially wiped out, Robin, already,
yeah,
by the actions of the managers of these companies. Nothing at all to do with the government. It's a tragedy, and it was all due to the private sector. These banks are worth about between 1 and 5% of what they were worth 18 months ago because they messed up so badly. And yet, almost all of the executives who ran these companies into the ground remain where they are. And very, very few board members of these companies have resigned. It's an extraordinary, mind-boggling failure of governance up and down throughout the big financial institutions in this country.
Simon Johnson, former chief economist with the IMF. When we come back, Simon says Europe would rather blame the U.S. for the financial mess than look at their own track record. We'll have that. Meanwhile, as we heard, Simon sides with economists like Nobel laureate Paul Krugman, who say the U.S. has to get over its fear of nationalizing banks and financial institutions to reorganize them. Krugman has quite a following. We want to leave you with a little of one of the new YouTube videos encouraging him to get a bigger role in Washington.
On the front lines, not just writing for the New York Times. I feel better.
Back in a minute, here now.
Instead of writing your blog and probably thinking a lot, I mean, don't you have some influence? Why aren't you secretary?
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to Here and Now. Our guest is Simon Johnson, former chief economist at the IMF. He's written an article in The Atlantic magazine called The Quiet Coup, in which he argues that smashing the U.S. financial oligarchy is the only way to fix the banking system. But Simon, we also want to ask you about the G20 summit that President Obama will attend in London. It starts Wednesday. The big discussions take place Thursday. And we're reading today that a draft communique has already been leaked, and it doesn't contain specific plans for a coordinated global fiscal stimulus package. That seems to be at the heart of what's shaping up to be a polite battle between Western Europe in particular and the Obama administration. Why is Western Europe so against more spending to get out of this financial mess?
Well, the essence of the problem, Robin, is that the governments in the major countries in Europe that are in power today were in power in 2007, 2008. And if they acknowledge the depth of their problems and the severity of the issues that are now facing them, then they will implicitly be acknowledging that they were asleep at the wheel in 2007, 2008. They were warned repeatedly and in public, for example, by the IMF about the problems that were coming. And they chose not only to ignore those warnings, but also to shoot as many messengers as they could lay their hands on. So there is no way for the Europeans to deal with these problems head on in public without acknowledging that they made major mistakes in the past. So, you know, when any, sophisticated, experienced politician meets this kind of dilemma, they obviously resort to a lot of obfuscation, smoke screens, and spinning.
Well, what about the reports that the resistance, for instance, from Germany is because they feel they already have social safety nets? Kurzarbeit, I don't know if I'm saying that correctly, which translates as short work, is a program that they have that they say is far better for their workers, and they don't need to spend more.
Well, it is true that some European countries, including Germany, has much stronger social safety nets than in the United States. And the call, of course, for a global fiscal stimulus was not particularly because we were afraid of what would happen to German workers, but because the Obama administration was correctly emphasizing the need for the world to work together in a coordinated fashion to pull the entire global economy out of its problems. And basically, the German response is, we'll be fine. Check with us later on how everything else went. If that's their attitude, terrific. Let them get on with it. I don't see why they should sit at the table of the G20. That should be for countries that really want to show leadership and that feel responsible for the global system. And frankly, for countries that helped get us into this mess and recognize the need to work together to get us out of it.
Well, and some reports are saying that the Germans are being so resistant because they really haven't felt this downturn. They didn't have a real estate bubble as Ireland did, and they're just not getting it.
I think that makes sense. But remember, you know, Germany claims to have a leadership role in the European context. You can't claim to have this sort of role unless you're willing to step up to the plate and really, really deliver. And I think this summit will fail largely because of this German attitude.
Well, that's kind of discouraging. You know, we already know it's going to be a failed summit. Tell us more. What will the failures be?
Well, I think there's three failures at three levels. First of all, there's the issues that aren't put on the table. So monetary policy will not be discussed because there's this fiction of independent central banks, and the meeting is for heads of government, and they're not supposed to talk about central banks. Well, that's an anachronistic notion in a crisis this severe. Okay, so that's the first failure, things that aren't discussed. The second failure is things that are discussed or were discussed, actually put on the table by Secretary Geithner. He had a very sensible, integrated approach that he put forward at the ministerial meeting a couple of weeks ago, which included a fiscal stimulus. It included much more progress towards sensible regulation. And those have really been shot down by the Europeans. I mean, their regulatory response in Europe is all kinds of complicated supranational structures that they're going to erect on exactly the same base that failed us going into this crisis, and it makes no sense, right? How can you build more on the same weak foundations and hope that the next house is going to be stronger?
I think one of them, and I think you write about this, is the proposed International College of Supervisors. What would that be?
It sounds like somewhere between a dysfunctional committee and a massive boondoggle, and I think that's exactly what it would be. You know, it's people looking over each other's shoulders to look over each other's shoulders to see that, you know, nothing really is happening, and then agree not to criticize each other. It's at best meaningless.
Well, and your third point is that you say that the refrain is that we face a global problem that needs a global solution. This is what world leaders, Gordon Brown of Britain in particular, are saying. But you say the most pressing problems in 2009 are not so much global as they are European. What do you mean?
Well, there's a big slowdown in Eastern Europe. There are currency crises and banking crises. Most of the banks in Eastern Europe are owned by West European banks. So everything that happens in the East, in the countries that were formerly communist, formerly in the Soviet Union, is going to spill over back to Western Europe, to Austria, for example, to Greece, and to Sweden. And there's also big problems with the housing sector slowdown in Western Europe, in the UK, Ireland, and Spain. They have housing busts that are actually worse than what we're seeing in the U.S. And in addition, we've got some, you know, open economies in the middle of Europe that are suffering big collapses in exports, including, by the way, Germany. But not only Germany, it's also affecting Italy and France. So everyone is affected. It's a big downturn. They need some sensible measures. To save themselves from this and to turn things around, and they don't want to talk about it.
Well, Simon Johnson, we close yet another conversation with you, completely depressed, because you say the U.S. doesn't want to deal with what you and others feel it has to do, which is nationalize banks and turn them around and resell them, break them up and turn them around and reprivatize them, and that Europe doesn't seem to want to deal with its problems. Where do you see this heading?
I think it's going to be a long, slow, painful recovery process. If we're lucky, Europe will dodge the bullet, and then we just struggle with the fact that a lot of people around the world feel they have too much debt. I do think the U.S. will turn itself around quicker than other countries. I just don't think it's going to come very fast. And I think we'll come out of it with a financial structure very similar to the one that brought us to this point of near ruin. And of course, the danger is that next time around, they will actually take us completely into ruin.
Simon Johnson. We'll connect you to his very popular blog at our website, hereandnow.org. He's senior fellow with the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He's also a professor at MIT Sloan School of Management and former chief economist at the IMF in 2007 and 8. Simon, there's not a lot of silver lining yet, but we do appreciate speaking with you.
My pleasure.
Starting tomorrow, 6 volunteer astronauts from Russia, France, and Germany will find out what it's like to spend 3 months in isolation. For 105 days until July, they will be locked inside a mock space module in Moscow as part of an experiment to test human endurance for a possible manned mission to Mars. The real trip to Mars could take up to a year. For comparison, the flight to the moon takes about 3 days. Tomorrow is the start of the second round of this mock flight to Mars. Later this year, a 520-day simulated mission will begin. The BBC's Richard Galpin visited the volunteer astronauts in Moscow recently and prepared this report.
It's 40 years since American astronauts from the Apollo 11 mission touched down on the moon.
Hello, Apollo 11, Houston. We'd like you to press on to...
It was a turning point in our history, the first time human beings had stepped on anything beyond planet Earth.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Oh, that looks beautiful from here.
It has a stark beauty all its own. It's like much of the high desert of the United States.
Since then, space agencies around the world have been pondering how to take the next big step, getting astronauts onto our neighboring planet, Mars. It's a round trip of up to 2 years.
We have enough water for at least 105 days.
Yeah, that's nice. It's not wrong.
Part of the answer may be found here inside a drab building in Moscow, where a crucial experiment is about to get underway. With 6 volunteer astronauts locking themselves inside a model spaceship until July as a test of their endurance.
As one of my crew members said, it's an honor for us to make first steps towards the Mars.
Sergei Ryazansky is the Russian commander of the spaceship. He says the primary aim of the experiment is to see how the crew cope with prolonged isolation and claustrophobia.
Definitely it will be not fun. Each test subject has this right to go out at any moment. But of course it will influence the whole experiment. So we will try to support him and to make his life here better.
The crew of 6 includes volunteers from France and Germany, neither of whom are professional astronauts. But Cyril Fournier, who's normally a pilot with Air France, is confident he'll be able to endure the 3-month confinement.
I consider myself as quite normal, but indeed you have to cope with the environment. That's the main point. You can be psychologically normal, but some people may be claustrophobic or may fear that something may happen. It is not my case, so I'm quite confident in that.
We were allowed inside before the mock spaceship was kitted out with all the scientific equipment needed for the astronauts to conduct a series of psychological and other experiments during their time on the simulated flight. They'll work day and night shifts of up to 10 hours, and they'll be eating the same kind of rations as on a real flight to Mars. The director of the project is former cosmonaut Boris Marukov.
We will not be able to resupply the spacecraft during the flight to Mars, so we have to know exactly how much food and water to take and how to recycle the air. On the approach to Mars, the delay in radio communications between the spacecraft and mission control will be 20 minutes, so the crew will have to deal with any emergency themselves.
And there are other major challenges ahead. For example, how to protect the crew from exposure to potentially lethal doses of solar radiation. But still, with the experiments now getting underway here in Moscow, Russian scientists are hopeful the first real flight to Mars may happen around the year 2030.
That's the BBC's Richard Galpin reporting from Moscow. To see a video of the mock spaceship that will be used for the experiment, go to our website, hereandnow.org. You're listening to Here and Now. Remember those old TV anti-drug ads? Well, this is your brain on Salvia Divinorum.
Oh, my God, Stephen. No, I had this dream.
What are you talking about?
Oh, my God, what was that?
That sound from one of thousands of YouTube videos showing how some people act after smoking something many of you have probably never heard of, Salvia Divinorum, a hallucinogenic herb that's been blamed for at least one suicide. Now, this is not the salvia people plant in their gardens. It's a subspecies of the genus grown in Oaxaca, Mexico, and used by shamans there for centuries. But a potent form of this salvia is readily available online, and it's the target of state bans and the focus of researchers who say it may hold promise as a prescribed drug. Dr. John Mendelson is a pharmacologist at the California Pacific Medical Center Research Institute. With a grant from the federal government, he's studying Salvia Divinorum's impact on humans. He joins us from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Welcome.
Thank you.
Its street names are Sally D and Magic Mint. And what does it do in this form?
We don't have really any scientific evidence about what it does. What we have are the reports of users. According to these individuals, it causes a fairly intense period of sensory distortion that lasts between 5 and 30 minutes, where people have what they describe as a transporting experience into some alternative reality.
And it's said that it has this hallucinogenic effect because of salvinorin A? What is that?
Salvinorin A is the most likely active compound in the drug. It has a unique chemical structure, and it has a unique mechanism of chemical action, which is that it activates something called kappa opiate receptors, apparently only kappa opiate receptors.
And explain what that means, kappa opiate receptors?
There are three types of opiate receptors, mu, delta, and kappa. And the mu receptors are ones that morphine and drugs like that act on. The mu receptors produce what's called analgesia, which is relief of pain. The kappa receptors are less well defined, but they exist in all of us, and they seem to be associated with some of the unpleasant effects of opiates, and they may also be associated with some of the emotional effects of opiates in a negative sense, in the sense that people have unpleasant experiences with opiates.
Well, then how do you explain all of these YouTube testimonials that people, you know, maybe that is the mania, just seem to be laughing like crazy, and it doesn't seem like a negative experience to them? I mean, they seem foolish. Fall on the floor and stuff, but it doesn't seem negative.
Sure. People are unlikely to post their unpleasant experiences. The best data we have right now suggests that about 1.8 million Americans have tried Salvinorin A, and very few of them try it more than three or four times. People don't find this drug to be something that causes a lot of, you know, pleasurable experience that they keep coming back to, and they want to experience over and over. They experience it a few times, then seem to stop.
Is that also because it may not be addictive?
It's much too early to know whether this drug causes addiction or not. There are factors that suggest that it might become addictive in some people, but there are many other factors that suggest that addiction is a very low risk for this particular agent.
Yeah. Well, one thing we do know, or at least the Delaware medical examiner seems to feel that he knows, that Salvia was a contributing factor in the death of a teenager, a Delaware's honor student, who killed himself after taking Salvia. So at least in one area, they think there's a connection to negative behavior. But you're saying we just don't know?
Well, yes, and that case was a very sad, unfortunate case, but the evidence that links Salvia to the suicide is very circumstantial and certainly not direct in any way. I should point out that so far, a lot of us are looking for complications of Salvia use. We're actually, you know, interested in and seeking cases, and we're not getting them so far. We have one case report in the literature of a complication from Salvia combined with marijuana, and this one coroner's report. Other than that, we do not have any published information on adverse effects with the drug.
Well, still, there's a growing movement against this one form of salvia. More than a dozen states have banned it. Others are considering taking that step. And we understand that has researchers worried that, you know, classifying Salvia divinorum as a Schedule I narcotic might put an end to their work to develop it as a pharmaceutical agent. What do scientists say it may be good for?
Well, we're not really 100% sure what it's good for right now. There's certainly trials looking at mania. There are some hints that it may be useful in HIV. But we are at such an early point of drug development that we really can't say with any confidence what it might be good for. We can say that scheduling drugs, that decreases the interest of investors in investing in the product. Mm-hmm. If we schedule it here, it's unlikely to attract any capital for drug development.
John Mendelson, pharmacologist at the California Pacific Medical Center Research Institute. He's been studying Salvia divinorum's impact on humans. John, thanks so much for your time.
Excellent. Thank you very much also.
Well, let's turn to a mother with a very different view of Salvia divinorum. In January of 2006, her son, 17-year-old Brett Chittister, committed suicide in his father's garage in Newark, Delaware. Kathleen Chittister blames her only son's death on his use of Salvia divinorum. Delaware lawmakers approached her after his death, and she helped them pass Brett's law, a ban on the herb. She's now working to extend that ban nationwide. Kathleen Chittister joins us now. And first of all, this we know is still very raw for you, so thank you so much for speaking to us.
Yeah, you're welcome.
But can you draw the line directly from Salvia to your son's suicide?
We definitely can. We found out that Brett was smoking Salvia in June of 2005. We found out that he was actually smoking it several times a week. His girlfriend had told me that.
Well, and he told his girlfriend that he felt there was something wrong with him, but he couldn't figure out what it was. And he left, notes behind that he assigned some of his feelings to Salvia. What did he say?
He had written in his suicide note that he had learned the secrets of life and that he couldn't go on living. And we had that note analyzed by a psychologist, and he said he was definitely under the influence of a drug when he wrote this note.
And you also knew that he was using the salvia because he talked to you about it. He told you it's legal. There can't be anything wrong with it.
Exactly. When I found out that he was smoking it, I confronted him, and he said, "Mom, it's legal. There's nothing wrong with it. You know, if it was a problem, it wouldn't be legal."
Well, what do you say to researchers like Dr. John Mendelson? He says he can't find scientific evidence of a link. One might be there, but he can't find it yet. And also that the ban you're behind, which has been successful in other states like California, Florida, Illinois, will drive salvia use underground. And also that researchers say that to ban it or classify it as a narcotic will put an end to the work they're doing that they say might show that salvia holds some promise for the treatment of addiction and depression and other things. So what do you say to their objections to the path you're on?
Well, the objection that it won't be able to be used for research if it's regulated is absolutely untrue. When we backed Brett's law in Delaware was that salvia would be available for research purposes only. So, you know, there's a lot of research out there. There's a lot more to be done. But I think at this point, to have children have it available to be used and experimented with until we know exactly what it does, I just think that's unacceptable. And I know exactly what it did in Brett.
Kathleen Chittister, what would you say to other parents if they're now concerned about this? What do they look for? How do you know?
When I found out about it, Brett told me that he had stopped, so I was a little bit complacent. And I would tell parents, don't be that way. Expect the worst and hope for the best.
Kathleen Chittister of Wilmington, Delaware, whose 17-year-old son Brett committed suicide. She feels the herb salvia was the cause. Kathleen, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Just a few of the hits that Rock and Roll Hall of Famers Earth, Wind & Fire had in the late 70s, which immediately became connected with good memories of summer vacations and high school proms. And by the way, if you're planning a prom, you've got to include this song. Because as the night goes on, every guy will try to do this. But though many have tried, few have succeeded in hitting the high notes that Philip Bailey hits. Philip Bailey is lead singer for Earth, Wind & Fire. He was in Boston recently to meet and perform with students at the Berklee College of Music. When he visited our studios, we asked, what is your highest note?
I have no idea.
And is it 4 octaves?
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah.
How do you, well, first of all, when you're talking to young people, what do you tell them about the voice?
I tell them that this is our instrument, a vocalist, and to just continue to discover it, allow it to take you wherever destiny would take you.
How do you care for it? Do you do vocal exercises? Or
I do work out, and I think that it does definitely help with the breathing and with the projection. And I'm kind of like a frustrated wannabe instrumentalist. Saxophone was one of the instruments that I just love. So I'm just making sounds.
You've become a human saxophone.
Yeah, right. Of course, I've studied. Then I have vocal exercises that I have made up and that I'll do. Say, like, if I have to go sing the national anthem somewhere, I'm going to go to some bathroom someplace and make sure that I'm good and warmed up and sing the high note first.
Well, let's make believe that this is a bathroom. And you have to sing the national anthem tonight. I mean, do you mind doing, I mean, probably to back away from the mic a little bit, do you mind doing a little exercise for us?
Well, see, like, if you're going to, first thing you want to do is always go, land of the free. You want to start there. You want to do that first without anyone listening, because that's the note that you want to make sure that you can sing. All right? And then you go, oh, say, you want to start there. Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's well, make sure you can sing that.
It's great. Play ball.
Let's play.
By the way, you are one of America's voices, and, you know, probably asked to do a lot of anthems.
I have been asked several times. The latest one was in my hometown, Denver, Colorado, at the World Series.
Oh, cool. How cool to be in your hometown.
That was pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, you first joined Earth, Wind & Fire in 71. It had already gone through at least one personnel change, and you joined founder Maurice White. And have said over the years that your influences were Miles Davis, John Coltrane. You've already said that you wish, you could be a saxophonist.
Right.
You know, you're sort of a jazz musician who ended up in popular music. I want to listen to another song now. It's September.
Interestingly enough, you know, on September, I think I have to give you a little secret.
Oh boy.
I really, when I first time I heard September, or when we first started doing it, I just did not think that song was going to do very much. And I remember we were on the road, and Alma Kay used to start this, and Maurice would sing this, you know, ba-de-da-de. I just thought it was so corny. I was like, oh my God, are you guys sure? This is really kind of corny. Lo and behold, man, you know, just to let you know that you don't always have it right. Huh?
Maurice White said that the essence of the band is hope.
Well, he's always said that, you know, the purpose of the band philosophically has been to render service to humanity. And so that's the reason why we chose to be true to the kind of people that we are, to what we believe, and to lift the consciousness of our listeners.
Well, and it's hard to, you know, especially younger people who are, you know, huge Earth, Wind & Fire fans all over the building, and but it's hard, you know, for the young people to understand the context that the band was formed in. This was the 70s. It was
right.
A kind of a dark, flat decade. Watergate and post-Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, here comes Earth, Wind & Fire, and they're wearing African robes, you know, in performances. And sometimes, you know, magic performances from Doug Henning. But how much of it was it also pride, but also black pride?
Well, it definitely was a way for us to reinvent what the perception of a lot of musicians had been about being, you know, really down and out.
And then comes this sunshine.
Right.
You guys.
Yeah, it was the timing of everything, the music, the message. Everything that little mix almost had to work very well together in order for Earth, Wind & Fire to have the kind of run, to have the kind of success or impact that we were able to have. Great memories associated with those songs.
Well, for us as well. Philip Bailey, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.